Welcome back to In the Moment. This summer, SDPB brings you highlights from the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's 2017-2018 season. Our Summer with the Symphony series offers uninterrupted recordings of live performances from the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls, including insight into the history of the music and the artists who created and performed it. Later this hour, we bring you Redis by Silvestre Revueltas. But first, we bring you back to a conversation between South Dakota Symphony Orchestra maestro Delta David Geyer and musicologist Joseph Horowitz. Horowitz visited with the South Dakota Symphony during the performance of Music Unwound, Aaron Copland in Mexico. The two men sat down in the studio together to talk about the shaping of taste, the commodification of culture, and Horowitz's Music Unwound project.
I'm sitting with Joseph Horowitz, author and historian, concert producer. Joe, you literally wrote the book, Classical Music in America. What's your perspective on where we are in this particular moment?
I think orchestras in this country right now are mostly dysfunctional. I have a very harsh opinion. It was because I discovered my own disappointment in the musical life around me that I undertook to try to figure out what went wrong. And the first thing I discovered was that there really was no institutional history of classical music in America.
That's a big statement.
And that's how I happened to write that book, Classical Music in America, A History of Its Rise and Fall. Nobody had very much studied, for instance, the history of the orchestra as it's transpired in the U.S. And to my amazement, I discovered a vibrant history that peaked before World War I. This took me completely by surprise because we don't remember our past. And it turns out that the peak moment in the history of the Metropolitan Opera, the peak moment in the history of the Boston Symphony, these moments occurred in the 1880s, 1890s, and early 20th century. Everything was working. For one thing, audiences were not estranged from new music. For another, they couldn't hear music at home unless they played it on the piano, because there's no radio, and there's no phonograph. And as important, there were institutional leaders of vision, colossal figures, the two most notable being Theodore Thomas and Henry Higginson, names hardly remembered, but Henry Higginson invented the Boston Symphony, and Theodore Thomas created an itinerant world-class orchestra that was instrumental in introducing the orchestra to all parts of the United States, including the part in which we're situated this morning having this conversation.
That's quite an extraordinary story. I mean, it's trying to imagine what years are we talking about when he was—
Beginning in the 1860s, he's touring America.
Yeah.
With a full-sized orchestra.
Wow.
And it's called the Thomas Highway, and it's a world-class orchestra. You have to absorb the fact that there are no radios and no phonographs. So if you're hearing the Thomas Orchestra, it is the first exposure to the sound of a symphony orchestra. So all that good stuff happened, and then it all went into a long period of decline after World War I. Orchestras failed to innovate, and these great leaders, great cultural leaders, shapers of taste, for whatever reason, they disappear and they're replaced by businessmen.
So is that what happened, what we might call the commodification of culture?
Yes, I could even identify a villain for you.
Yeah.
The villain in my book is named Arthur Judson.
Yeah.
He's at one moment running the Philadelphia Orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, and Columbia Artists Management at one and the same time, Columbia Artists Management being by far the most powerful artist management. Almost all the conductors are managed by Arthur Judson, so he's got his fingers everywhere. And he makes the historic statement that the audience shapes taste. This is in the 1930s. No one had ever articulated that statement before. To my knowledge, among the leaders of American classical music, it was always their assumption that individuals of vision would shape taste, whether, usually conductors.
So is this another version of the customer is always right?
Yes, exactly that. And that's exactly what Judson said, because the circumstances behind this statement were as follows. Judson's orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, did very conservative programs compared to what Koussevitzky was doing in Boston and Stokowski was doing in Philadelphia, and there were complaints. And the complaints took the form of letters to the New York Times, and the New York Times invited Judson to respond. He rarely said anything publicly, but he did on this occasion. He made a statement for the New York Times, and he said, "We cannot go any further than the audience will take us." He was specifically commenting on why the Philharmonic was not doing more Mahler or Bruckner. He said, "I can only go as far as the audience will take us." And he went further and he said, in his opinion, a masterpiece like the Beethoven Fifth Symphony could not be overplayed. He said he looked forward to a time when it was played even more frequently than it was being played already in the 1930s. So this is a smoking gun in my own research. When I found this statement, my eyes popped out of my head and I realized its historic significance. What we take for granted today, that the marketplace dictates programming or getting a celebrity pianist or playing a well-known piece, was really unknown before the First World War. That's just not how it was done. An orchestra, a conductor, would choose the pieces that he felt were important to be played, and box office was not a consideration. I know conductors who are constantly being overruled by the marketing department of the orchestra.
Yeah, well, it's always a dance because you obviously want to play pieces that people love and want to hear because we have this great history of wonderful music. But at the same time, it's a living, breathing art form and needs that nurturing to bring it forward. Was Arthur Judson also involved with the music appreciation movement?
I would say they were concurrent. He was not actively involved in the merchandising of the music appreciation literature or the creation of the music appreciation broadcasts. The closest he came to that was his invention of community concerts. Do you remember community concerts?
I read about them in your book.
So community concerts no longer exists, but for decades, what Judson would do was go to a presenter, say in Sioux Falls, and say, "Here are the artists that I have." And the presenter would say, "Oh, I want that one." And he'd say, "Well, you can have that one, but you have to take this one and the other one." What's pertinent here is the control of repertoire. They were the people who were creating the literature, creating the broadcasts, and they were interested in selling their product. And the product that they could best sell was what was familiar already. So the deck is stacked against American music. The deck is stacked against new music. If they've got Toscanini recording the Beethoven 7th Symphony with the New York Philharmonic, that's what they want to sell that you're going to appreciate, is the music that they've got on sale on recordings.
Why is this music important?
Certainly this music has always been of enormous importance to me in ways that are not entirely predictable. I don't know if this is the direction in which you want to go, but certainly my sense of self, my sense of history, my sense of America, my sense of the contemporary moment are all partly shaped by my exposure to music.
Mm-hmm.
Music encapsulates history. You can learn a lot about the past just by knowing the music of the past. And I happen to favor history as an instrument for self-understanding. If I didn't know music and the history of music, I'd be a completely different person.
So this is a very interesting topic, this idea that art helps us
understand ourselves.
Yes, individually and corporately, and to find our place in the world.
Yeah, and to grow.
But it can have a negative effect depending upon the kind of art you're consuming.
Yes, you know, I would agree with that too.
You know, if it's shallowly conceived, then you end up with an impoverished view of yourself and of the world.
I completely agree with you, David.
Yeah. I would argue that that's one reason that this that these cultural institutions, artistic institutions, are very important. Symphony orchestras, theater companies, museums. You have come up with a different take on this, a humanities-infused programming.
I think that orchestras should be humanities institutions. Yes. That's what museums are.
Yes.
If you go to a museum exhibit, it's curated, and it's telling you a story, and it's usually expressing an opinion. It'll maybe take an artist and say, his late work is more important than you thought, or he resonates with a particular historical moment in ways you may not have noticed, or he reinterprets the past. A museum exhibit typically has a theme and a thesis, and it enriches our lives accordingly. Concerts given by orchestras typically have neither a thesis nor a theme. So I've spent 3 decades creating and producing concerts that have a theme and a thesis. Now that I'm running this thing called Music Unwound, which is a national consortium of orchestras and universities funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, we've stumbled into a template where all the themes have to do with the American experience. There are 5 of them: Dvorak's America, Copland in Mexico, Kurt Weill's America, Charles Ives in America, and the new one, which has to do with the influence of jazz. And I do believe that these programs, which are scripted and multimedia, speak to the question, who are we? And how did we become what we are as Americans? I think these programs speak very powerfully to those questions. They certainly do for me.